Today is May 8th, 2008, and my name is Rob Wilmington, and I'm here with Larry Powers in his house on Frederick Street in North Bennington. And Larry, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
I was born in North Bennington in 1920 in the building in the back of Powers Market. I've moved a grand total of three blocks in 88 years. And I've watched the village of North Bennington change and change back to where it was. And I think that right now it's a lot closer to where it was in 1920 than we realize.
Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that? That's intriguing.
Well, in the 1920s, North Bennington was a railroad hub. All the traffic on the railroads came through North Bennington, not to Bennington. So while we were the village, a small village in the western part of the town, there was an awful lot of activity in North Bennington. And we had three very, very good factories that were employing probably 500 people. A lot of them came from outside, but came to the town to work in the factories, and most of them had farms on the outside. So we were kind of a rural community with industry. And the industry was a backbone for this community for, oh, up until the 1970s. Now those factories are still here. They're all making a different product than they did then, but they're all going. So the village hasn't changed all that much. We've changed a lot of people, but that's because people have come and moved in here and moved away. Bennington College came and started in 1927, and by 1932, when the first class came, a lot of people in the village went to work at the college. A lot of mothers and wives worked there as maids because the college needed that kind of help. So there was an extra source of income from Bennington College, which helped the village. The influx came as the college progressed and grew. A lot of that came to North Bennington. Faculty people bought houses here, raised their families here, and when the college got big enough and they started taking in men's students, they didn't have enough place on the campus, so they allowed students to come and live in the village. That changed the village tremendously right there.
How did that change the village?
Well, the students, one thing, we ran a grocery store. My wife and I were actually sub-mothers and fathers for the kids because they had to talk to somebody when they had problems. But they were all very nice, and there was no problems from them, but there are a lot of them that lived in the village. We did have a very active bar in North Bennington, which they all went to, and that was known far and wide as the Villager. And it's amazing when you talk to people now who heard about the Villager that didn't even live here. So it changed, but the village pretty much is the same structure that was in 1920.
What do you think has changed the most since 1920?
The school.
How so?
In 1920, up until 1940, maybe 50, you went to school from kindergarten through senior high school. And then in the 50s, they built a regional high school in Bennington, and that took all the high school students out of the village. That changed. And now they just built a new middle school, and that's going to take some more students. I think we're in danger of losing our school. And I hate to see that because that's been really been one of the pillars of the village.
Because of the support that families have brought to it, or because of the continuity it's provided for generations? Or?
Oh, I think the school was a bulwark for families. Families were involved, more so in the 30s and 40s than they are now. But the school had a lot of things going on. They had a big music program, so as a result, there was always something going on with the music program. The school produced plays and things, which got the village involved. And we were pretty much a composite here. That all disappeared. We don't have those things in the village anymore. In fact, we've almost gotten to the point where they want to do away with village meeting. And that scares me. It really does, because we don't have the continuity that we had.
Was North Bennington disconnected from Bennington when the trolley service ended, or was there always very active in your lifetime, very active going back and forth between here and Bennington, even, you know, before the war?
Growing up here before the war, we hitchhiked back and forth to Bennington practically every day. People knew us and we knew them. There was no danger, anything like that. So kids were always going back and forth on the road. The trolleys ended about the time that I was 6 or 7. I rode them, remember, once. The train I rode once. But they all disappeared in 27, 28. So we don't have much, didn't know much about them.
So you could just reliably go start walking out by the store and someone would give you a lift right into the center of Bennington?
I went to business college in Bennington 1940 and 41. And every morning when we lived in where Powers Market is now, when I would have breakfast, I'd go out and stand on the corner and I would get a ride to school. And when school was over, I'd get a ride back. We never were late. We always got rides back and forth.
And your parents didn't worry about you one bit, I bet.
And my brother, 1 year behind me, did the same thing. Huh. And no one worried about us then.
Did many people commute from Bennington to the factories here in North Bennington?
That was strange. We had people commuted from North Bennington to Bennington to work, but people from Bennington come to North Bennington to work. We had a lot of people from Hoosick Falls that came here to work. Huh. So, yeah. Coming in the automobile changed the village a lot.
How so?
I can remember when you saw 5 cars a day going through North Bennington. It was a big group. Excuse me. Now, we're like a main drag through here. The traffic has built up tremendously. But I always like to tell the story that when Hall McCullough first came here, there were only 3 cars in the village. And he had one of them. And when everything went on, if they had a parade or something, everybody had to go and ask him if he would drive a car in their parade.
When were the roads paved?
The first hard surface road from North Bank to Bennington was 27. Bill Daly got one of the contracts for supplying a truck to haul the cement. The crew that built that street was an Italian crew from down near Connecticut. They came here, and they almost poured the concrete by hand to build that road. That was the first hard surface road. But we moved up here in 50, and Mechanic Street was not paved. In the spring, you had to pick the right ruts to get up the road. Because the road was in terrible shape.
So the village taxpayers just did that over a period of time?
Yes, there was a time, I think it was probably in the 1919 and 20, after World War I, they decided they wanted to build some houses in North Bennington. There weren't many. They built Hall Street, which was up from the school past the Baptist Church. And several industrious men in the village all built a house. When they sold them, they would build another one. Those houses were all built by individual men in the village and to make the village bigger.
And we're sitting here on Frederick Street. Do you remember when Frederick Street was built?
Mm-hmm.
And why was this little connection put in?
Frederick B. Jennings gave a strip of land 50 feet wide from College Road to Mechanic Street sometime in the 1930s. But nothing was ever done. When we were able to buy this land here to build this house, we put the house facing the east. And the village then had to build a street to accommodate us. And that was built, and Mr. Payne, who was one of the trustees, proposed at a village meeting, they named the street Frederick Street after Frederick E. Jennings.
So you had the lot, you built the street, the house facing a street that didn't exist, and the village put it in because they had the right of way. Very good.
Well, I'll tell you, can I take 2 minutes of your story?
Please.
My father lived in the house two downs from here. And when I was a boy, we played baseball in where this house is. And Mr. Elwell had cows up in here, So you had to be careful where you step when you played baseball. But after we got married and we were living in a white hotel, we used to go up here and walk around, and we thought this was a nice place to build a house. So I went to Mr. Wilde, who was running the Jennings estate. The college had started, but the estate was still there by the Jennings, and told her I'd like to buy this lot. She said, well, we just had that land all surveyed. There's three lots there. The lot you want is $1,000. I said, well, that's much too much money. Well, she said, I'm not allowed to dicker. That's the price. So I said, well, but there's a piece of that lot that's very steep hill in back. You can't use it? She said, Mr. Powers, if you would like to make an offer to Mrs. Franklin in New York, I'll give you her address. So I wrote Mrs. Franklin a letter, told her that I was born in North Bennington. I had my family here and I wanted to build a house. And we looked at their lot and we thought it was a nice place for a house. Well, it's going to cost $1,000. We didn't think that was right. We'd like to make her an offer of $600 for the lot. I got a letter back from Mrs. Franklin thanking me for my letter. Said, I want you to know I'm going to accept your offer. Not for any arguments you've put forth, but in memory of your great uncle James, who was our coachman.
It's a wonderful story.
$600.
And did you build the house yourself, or
yeah,
did you hire someone out?
We found a plan we liked, and I had an uncle who was a carpenter, and my uncle said he'd build it for us, and I could help him. So I took 6 months off from work. I was here during the day, and when I go back to the store and work after he left, and we built this house for we built it for $6,000, and then I got called back for the Korean War. So we borrowed another $1,000 and put the doors and windows in, and we left and went to Texas for 2 years. Yeah.
A babe went with you to Texas?
And we had two kids then too.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So we were going. We left here in July of 51 and came back in January of 53.
And you've been here for 55 years since then.
Mm-hmm.
Larry, I want to go back to the 1920s. Do you think that North Bennington in the 1920s and 30s, when you were growing up, was different from many other small Vermont towns in the area? Was there something distinctive about it that you could describe?
If there was a difference, it was the trains. That made a great deal of difference because there was a lot of activity in that one area. Other than that, I've driven through many, many towns in North Bennington, especially going back and forth to Montpelier. They were just like this place. They had the store, they had a gas station, and that was it.
And did the railroad change it because of the business activity, because of the passengers? Or?
Passengers. There was a lot of freight, but passengers. See, when I was a boy, we had six passenger trains a day through the village. We had a passenger train early in the morning, one in the afternoon, and one at night.
And they all stopped at the station?
Yeah. The morning train, the up flyer in the morning would stop here and go on as far as Burlington or Montreal. Then another one about early afternoon would do the same thing. There would also be one coming from the other direction at other times. In 1939, when I graduated from high school, we got on a train in North Bennington at 11 o'clock at night and went to New York. And spent a week in New York and came back right to North Bennington on the trains. Yeah. There was a lot of activity. Now, I have to go back. You can cut this when you're done. Mr. Harris was a station agent in the village for years and years and years. And before radio, if there was something going on in the sporting world, if you wanted what was going on, you went to the railroad station. Because the station agents were always talking to each other on the telegraph. There was a very, very big World Series game on. Half the men in North Bank were at the railroad station to hear the score. And the game kept getting more exciting and more exciting and more exciting. The score was tied in the ninth inning. Everybody's waiting to find out what's going on, and finally, the telegraph started clicking away. And Mr. Harris got up and said, "It's all over, boys. It's all over. They won one run in the ninth inning." And so I said, "Who won?" He says, "My God, I forgot to ask."
Was this Yankees country or Red Sox country?
Oh, I think it was Red Sox more than anything else. Huh. Yeah, but I can remember that railroad station had a ladies' waiting room and a men's waiting room. There was always somebody there.
Were there any real sort of second homeowners before the college got going? And you had professors and
Visitors? People came here for the summer. Like, you know where Dave Aldrich lives? The Hewling family came from New Jersey for the summer. They were there. And, of course, there were always somebody at McCullough's and at Jennings. And the surrounding families came for the summer. But there was not... there were not a lot of people that came came for a weekend or anything.
Did the end of Prohibition seem to change life in the village at all?
Yes, it did. It meant that you could buy a legal drink on Main Street when before you had to go out in somebody's backyard and drink it out in the barn. We had two or three men in the village that supplied the needs for liquor all through Prohibition.
And when you say liquor, were they doing hard liquor or beer? Or
hard liquor, and they didn't have any license, didn't have anything else, but they'd give you a drink.
Would they bring it down from Canada, or would they make it themselves, or some combination?
It's weird you should ask that question. Clyde Peck, is that a name that you're familiar with?
Peck, yes.
Clyde Peck was a sheriff in Bennington. Mm-hmm. A big, big man. But he ran the town. He got a new deputy. He told the deputy, "Don't go near the East Road." And one night the deputy called him on the telephone and said, Sheriff, you'll have to come." "Why?" He said, "I just got a carload of Canadian beer right on the East Road." And the sheriff said, "You damn fool, that was for me."
What's your source of that story?
I knew Clyde Peck. Up until the present sheriff we've got, the sheriff was a one-man operation. John Maloney, Clyde Peck. When John Maloney was sheriff, his wife cooked for anybody who was in the jail. And we had a man named Jess Woodard who drank. And every once in a while, he would get arrested and he'd have to go to jail. And John Maloney, as a sheriff, took care of the jail. So Jess would get put in jail for 5 days or 3 days or whatever. So one day his sentence was up and John Maloney went in and said, "Okay, Jess, you can go home now." He says, "God, John, no sense today. It's raining."
That's great. Larry, did national political campaigns back in the days when people would go to the railroad station to find out the ball scores, did national political campaigns have a big impact in the village? Did people pay attention?
Before television, we had a North Bank Democratic Club. It was a big one. And we worked real hard. And we got a lot of people elected. This is the time of Phil Hoff and Bill Meyer and those people. And there were lots of activities. Republicans had a very big club in Bennington.
Do you have a theory as to why North Bennington had more Democrats?
I think because of mills and anything else. They were workers.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any attempt to organize the mills to have a leader?
I don't think so. Fred Welling, I'm going to bring up a name. Fred Welling always worked on the polls here. His family was well known, and he was a well known man. And he was a chairman of the board of trustees of the village, on the board of the bank, on the board of the railroad, everything else. So they had an election one time, and they knew it was going to be very close. And the head of the Republican Party in Bennington was Dash Gibney. And Dash saw how things were going, and he came over to see Fred. They had the polls then in the old yellow firehouse where Mrs. Feely owned. And Dash came into Fred, and he said, "Fred, if we're going to win this one, everybody here is going to eat 3 votes. The poll workers chewed down 3 ballots, and they won."
Oh, no.
Fred told me one time they actually threw some votes out the window in the firehouse.
Did Roosevelt carry North Bennington, do you know?
Oh, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did, yeah.
Oh, so when Vermont was going with Alf Landon in 1936, the village here was still Democratic?
Yeah, because the village was all Catholic, and the Catholics all voted for Roosevelt.
Oh.
Yeah.
When did the St. John's change from the location on Water Street over to Houghton Street?
27.
And why was that?
It was an old building. It'd been all kinds of things, and hard to heat and everything else, and they decided to move it up here because it wasn't a very good location. You had to climb it with horses and wagons. They had big wagon sheds and things. So they owned the lot up here where the rectory is, and they moved a house and put the church in there.
Was it? Do you know if it was built by local Masons?
The general contractor was in Boston. I don't know who he employed, but I went to the first Mass in this church in 27.
Did you go to the last Mass in the old one?
No, but John Flood and I went to catechism down there when we were six years old, or five or six. And we came up here, and they didn't have any rooms. The church was just one room. So the nuns from the Sister of St. Joseph and Benyon came over on the bus or on the trolley and had catechism on Saturday morning in the church for us. And they broke us into four groups in the church. And John Flood, a good friend of mine, and you probably knew him.
Sure.
We were sitting in one room in the church, and John was practicing, trying to learn how to blow whistle through his fingers. All he'd go, couldn't make a sound. Put his fingers in his mouth one day and let out a shriek of a whistle that almost scared the nuns to death. We had to get out of the church.
What was that? I've seen photographs of the old church. It looked like a fairly simple building. It looked like not too dissimilar from many sort of Protestant churches.
It was a Protestant church, I think, originally.
Oh, I see. It was taken out.
Yeah. It had a big wagon shed in back. You see the picture of the wagon shed?
I have.
Huge wagon shed in back, yeah.
So the horses had to get up that incline, you leave the wagon in back,
yeah,
and come around.
Mm-hmm.
What role did the Cushman plant play in the village? Was it any different than the other factories?
Well, other than the fact that it was a family-operated business, Mr. Cushman had three sons. They were all in the business, too. And it wasn't always a successful business, you know. They made mission furniture for a long time, and it was just kind of a going on. But then all of a sudden, one day a man came in and showed them that he'd like to make a different kind of furniture. And they said they didn't know what to do. They didn't know whether they wanted to reconvert to a factory or anything. So he said they always went to the furniture shows in North Carolina to show their product. And he said that he would like to take some furniture they would make there down there to show them. But he wouldn't do that unless they put the stuff in rooms. So the factory made four rooms that could be transported and took a whole bunch of furniture down there and sold so much of it they never caught up with it. There's a million stories about that factory. They had so many problems toward the end. They lost control. They didn't have a good, there's a phrase, inventory control. And were having furniture stolen before it got made. They actually got an order for a director's table for a corporation in New York. It was a big one, biggest piece of furniture they ever made. And they got an order for that, and they made three of them. The one they made went to New York. The two others were stolen right out of the factory.
Good Lord.
You know, they had at one time when they got caught in the end, it was the help doing it. They had two loading docks at the factory, one for shipping, one for stealing. Yeah. They made so much money that they didn't worry about inventory control. If they had a table that had 25 pieces in it, all being made in different departments in there, would finally come to the assembly, and maybe when they got there, they only had 23 pieces and they needed two more. Instead of going back through the factory to find out where those two pieces were and why they didn't come, they had a department that would take what they didn't make and go up and rush through some orders of that and make it. And then when those pieces did come through, they burned them up on Saturday morning.
There must have been people who worked their entire career at that factory.
Oh, God.
Right?
There were people there that had been there for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And there were people. Did you know Charlie Breen? Is that a name you were in?
I know the name. I'm not sure I knew him personally.
Charlie Breen was a stainer. That factory, they would highlight the furnace by rubbing it.
There's a Reuben Green picture of him staining.
Yeah. Charlie Breen, when Cushman closed, Charlie Green opened a shop in Shaftesbury, and the rest of his life he spent restaining Cushman furniture.
Hmm. Can we talk a little bit about Reuben Green? Because you had
I want to tell you this one story.
Oh, please go.
I was working in the store one day, and Tubby Austin, who was a gopher for Cushman's, had to go get the mail and get this and get that. He came in the store and he said, "You sell Pledge?" I said, "Sure." He says, "Give me all you got." Pledge was a furniture pile. I said, "What the hell do you want all that Pledge for?" He said, "I'm not supposed to tell you." I said, "Oh, what is it?" Charlie Thompson and Bennington made the stain that Cushman stained their furniture with. He had a contract with him. He got it from Milwaukee, some off the place in Milwaukee. They ran out of stain one time, and a woman down in Dallas, Texas, bought a houseful of Cushman furniture. And they shipped it in a railroad car, a full car of furniture. They ran out of stain before they just shipped it, and one of the guys that worked in the factory said, "Hell, I can make just as good a stain as that old guy in Bennington. I'll make some stain." So he made a whole bunch of stain. And they stained that whole carload of furniture. Took it to Dallas, Texas. Got in this woman's new house full of furniture. She was going to have a big party and show all of her friends her new furniture. So she took a bottle of Pledge and went out, sprayed down her table, and every time she wiped it, she wiped the stain right off right down to bare wood. They bought all that Pledge from me to see whether they were going to have to go to Texas and stain it in Texas or bring it all back here to North Bennington.
Did they have to go to Texas?
I never knew about that. But I'll tell you one thing, I saw a lot of Pledge. A whole carload. There's stories like, there's a million stories like that. We could talk all night long, and I could tell you stories about that place.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the Fund for North Bennington has a website, and we have more people find that website because they're looking for Cushman furniture.
Oh, yeah?
Constantly. There's a big interest in it out there. Yeah. You know, 35 years or more after the after its
production. We got a house full of that.
That's great.
Mr. Bromley was a superintendent, lived down the street from us. So when Babe and I got married, he said, "Well, you're going to need some furniture." Yeah, he said, "We sell seconds, you know." I said, "Yeah, you do." He said, "If a piece comes through and there's a board that we don't like or something, we'll put it in the seconds and we'll sell it for half price." So I said, "Come down and pick out some someday." We went down and picked all the furniture we wanted out, and none of it was seconds. But we got it in seconds.
Great.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about Reuben Levin?
No, Reuben Green.
Reuben Green, I'm sorry. Why I said that.
Reuben Green. Reuben Green is a boy from Shaftesbury. Kind of a sissified. He never was a joiner. But he was very good at what he did. And he was down working in Payne's shop, which is down where the art exchange is. And one winter, the Baptist church and the Congregational church, men's clubs, had joint meetings. And Reuben went to the Congregational church, and Mr. Cushman went to the Baptist church. Reuben told me this story. They decided to have a debate. And the night of the debate, damned if Reuben didn't have to debate Mr. Big Bill Cushman. So Mr. Cushman was quite a stout man. He had a vest and with a big gold chain and a fob on it. He got up and told a story. And he said Reuben was going to answer his story. Reuben said, "Well, I'll tell you." He said, "There was a man who said there was a family of flies." He said it was a papa fly's job to go out and find food to bring in to feed the mama fly and the little babies. And one day, the papa fly flew into a grocery store and saw all this wonderful food. He loaded up on this food to take home to his family. And as he was flying out the door, the fryer of the store saw him and took a fly swatter and hit him and killed him. He said the moral of this story is, what was the moral? Anyway, there was a moral to the story. Oh, the moral of the story is, if you haven't got anything to say, keep your mouth shut. And sat down. Everybody clapped their hands. The next day, Mr. Willard, who was the controller of Cushman's, came up to the shop up here and said, "Mr. Cushman would like to see you." And Reuben said, "Well, I'll go see him when I'm through work." He said, "All right," and went down. And Mr. Cushman said, "Mr. Green, I liked your story last night. I'd like to give you a job." And that's how he got to work for him.
And he worked for him his whole career after that, didn't he?
And you know what his job was? He was hated in that factory. He was a time and motion study man. There was a guy named Ted Corliss who set the rates. In other words, if you had to run a machine to sand a table, you got so much an hour for doing that, and they determined your rate. Reuben would go in and see how long it took you to sand that table and what to get you up to an hourly rate. And the people hated him for it because he would always set the rates too low for them. They always thought they ought to get more. And he did that all his life. But he got involved in taking pictures and joined the Bennington Camera Club. And there were a lot of people from North Bennington in that too. And Reuben got so good, he got all kinds of awards for that. And finally, one time, when Fred Burkhart was the president of college, he'd seen some of his work, and they had a photography teacher at the college. And Burkhart said, "Well, I think you ought to go up and help her." And he went to work. And for 2 years, he taught photography at Benton College.
Did he show his work very much? Or was it pretty much just individuals saw it when he took the pictures?
No, the camera club set their displays all over. And all of his always had gold seals on them. Yeah, he had. In fact, they've got a whole bunch of his pictures up at the University of Vermont. I went up there one day and saw them. They're duplicates of what we have.
Hmm. And did he have the darkroom in his house?
Yeah, the whole thing. But he would move around. He got into ham radio at the same time, and he was contacting people all over the world, and doing his pictures at the same time. And he told me one day, I said, "Reuben, tell me how you take pictures." "Well, Larry," he says, "you have to understand, there's a focal point in every picture, and you've got to find that focal point to take a good picture." And I said, "Well, what kind of a camera you gotta have?" "Well," he said, "if you're any good at all, you get a Leica." I said, "Where'd you get one?" He said, "Germany." And he had a Leica that he took pictures with. But he had all kinds of cameras. And he was a real rare. He went all the basketball games, baseball games, anything like that. Took pictures every place he went.
His baseball photographs are really just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit about baseball in the village in those days? When you look at his pictures, it looks as if half the town, maybe the village, might be there watching games.
Welling Field was the site of the baseball games. The town teams then were very big. Hoosick Falls, Manchester, Arlington, Bennington, Sunderland. They all played home and home games. And then every once in a while they'd have an exhibition team come from Schenectady of black men to play, called the Mohawk Giants. you'd have 500 people down there watching him. They passed, never charged him, but they passed the hat, and you could put in what you wanted to. Usually they got enough money to pay for baseballs. And that was about it. But the side hill down here would be full of people.
And where was the game played in Bennington?
Right where the new high school is. You know where you're going up?
Park Street?
Park
Extension,
Street.
Yeah.
Is that Park?
Well, it's Park Street Extension, and it's East.
You come off
road.
North, what's the street up north? From North Street up.
From County?
Yeah, County Street.
Yeah.
Where County Street, where you went up toward the soldiers' home or the bridge out there, that's where home plate was. And it's called Alumni Field. And then they got so good, Jimmy Pleiotis ran the Paradise Restaurant. He sponsored the team. They built a good-sized grandstand there with a cover roof, and they played. They were in the Northern League for several summers, college league.
So, were any of the players paid, or was it all volunteer?
They were paid this way. He got some guys that come to play. Like, oh, I can't. The guy that did the Rifleman, he played here one whole summer, and several people like that came. He got them rooms and fed them, and they got paid like $25 a week.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was a professional team.
And did the high school, was high school baseball a big deal?
It was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was it? You think that was the most popular sport, or was basketball, or did it just depend on the season?
I think they were probably comparable. We had basketball got more personal. We had a situation one time where we played Arlington, end up in a fight.
Yeah, were you in that fight?
No.
You did play basketball.
Thank God I wasn't there. But they didn't. The fight ended up, they canceled the game, and one of the guys hit the Arlington coach and broke his jaw. And we didn't play them for 4 years.
To everyone who graduated, it had anything to do with it.
Well, it got very personal, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the impact of the McCullough family on the village?
You have to go back three or four generations. Turner Park came, and his father was Highland Hall. No, his father-in-law. Highland Hall owned everything. Turner went to California with him. Turner made a lot of money. And I refer you to a book called Dream West, which was the story of Colonel Fremont, going to the map maker. Fremont got called back, in California, he got called back for the Civil War. He left all of his holdings in charge of Turner Park. And Turner Park's book says that they needed to raise money to pay for the holdings for the gold. And they sold the stock that Fremont had left. So when they got all through, Fremont's stock was all gone. And when Turner came home, he came home with a lot of money. The rumor is that he came home with a cask in a barrel on the money, but I know I know exactly. They've never said what that was. But when he arrived here, he took one corner of his father's land and built a mansion. But the first thing he did when he came here is he built a bank, and he capitalized the bank with $1 million. And after the bank was going for, I don't know, 60, 70 years, the controller of the currency told him he had too much money in there to take the money out. But Turner Park was involved with De La Seppe, who built the Panama Canal, and Leland Stanford, and guys like that. His daughter married John McCullough, who was a lawyer in California, and they came here to live. And he decided he wanted to be a politician, so he wanted to become a governor. So he bought the local paper and hired a guy to run it. And when he became governor, he gave the paper to the guy that ran the thing. But he then, along came Hall McCullough, who was a very good businessman, and he made money for the family.
Did you know him very well?
Hall? Extremely well. Awfully nice man.
Was he here in North Bennington much of the year, or was he in New York most of the time?
He was probably here 6 months of the year. Every year when they would come from New York, we unfortunately did all the grocery business. I would go up and meet him the first day, and we went and have a talk. And he and I became very good friends. And when we had some problems in the village, the first problem we had, across from Tim Smith's now, where Percy's was, there was a very nice cottage. Some people lived in there, and it had gone down, they rented several times gone downhill. We had a terrible storm, and the catch basin in front of Percy's newsroom got plugged. And the water went right across the street and up against the front door of that house. The people lived there opened the door in the front and the back and let the water go right through the house, which ruined it. So it wasn't livable. About 2 years later, the barbershop where Pangea is, I was in there one morning and somebody said, you know, you ought to buy that house and tear it down. I said, you give me the money and I'll do that. So the guy was there, I'll give you $50. Somebody else was there. He said, he'd give us $50. Mr. McCullough came down to get a shave. He called me up and he said, could you come up? I said, sure, I want. He said, I understand you're in the construction business. I said, no, I'm in the destruction business. He said, from now on, anytime something in the village is not for snuff, if you'll take care of it, I'll supply the money. So we tore that building down. Then there was a mill on the other side of the firehouse dam. It had been a warehouse for Cushman's. That had a fire, and that was in bad shape. We bought that and tore that down with his money. Then the grist mills where the firehouse is now, we tore that down.
Was that in the 1950s, Larry?
I would think yes. After I get back to service. And
was that done, if I can ask you a question, was that done quietly? Did anybody besides you and a couple others know where the money came from?
Fred Welling, Art Wigan, and I.
The three of you.
We had a corporation called Ike, Mike, and Sammy. I was Sammy. So we were going to tear the grist mill down. Where the firehouse was, is now. And John McCullough came along with a friend of his from Montreal and thought that would make a wonderful boys' club.
The building that, as it stood there now?
They were going to do it over. No. So I went to see, Mr. McCullough told us to go ahead and tear it down. So I went to see him and I said, we're going to back off on the firehouse, on the grist mill. We don't want to get involved in anything here. And John thinks it would make a nice boys' club. So we aren't going to do anything. Mr. McCullough never swore. He said, thunder, what's John sticking his nose in for? I don't know. Well, John's friend told him it would cost him $1 million to do it. That pretty well took the bloom off the rose. About 3 months later, I went back and I said, I think we're back in business if you want us to tear it down. So we tore it down, and when we tore it down, we found two mill wheels in the bottom of the grist mill, big ones. So I went back and see Mr. McCullough, and I said, I got a problem. And we found two mill wheels in the bottom of that mill, and they're yours because you probably supplied the money. What do you want to do with them? He said, could you take a walk with me? And I said, sure. Went out in his rose garden, and he had a sundial on a mill wheel. They told me that mill wheel there came when they ground the grain for the Battle of Bennington, and the museum's been after it for 20 years. He said, I'd rather have a North Bennington mill wheel. If you bring me one of those down there, I'll give this one back to the museum. So that mill wheel is still up to McCullough's. But he would do anything for the village. They had a fire. One of his barns burnt. Got struck by lightning, and we all went. We couldn't save the barn, so we sprayed all the trees to save the trees. Next time we had a meeting, there was a check there for $500 from Mr. McCullough. He said, anybody can build a barn, but no one can build a tree. I'm glad you saved them. Now I want to go to Lake Perrin.
Please.
Because this involves him too. Stark Paper Company owned the water level at Lake Perrin. And they owned the gates that control the water level. The land where Lake Perrin swims now was owned by Stark Paper Company. And Barney McCarty had rented every year from him and put a raft out there and a pier.
Starting when, Larry?
Oh, in the early 30s. Was when I was in school over there. And Barney ran the bathhouse in the summer. When one time later on, probably in the 40s or maybe 45, Mason Welling took over Barney's operation. He was family. But it never worked for them. And Fred had been working on the dam the gate one day and fell and broke his leg. And it never healed. He died with a bad leg. And so Mason closed up. And it came around to us that we heard that Stark Paper would sell their holdings at Lake Perrin. Dick Dwyer, Junior Percy, several of us, had a meeting at the firehouse about buying Lake Perrin. Jim Holden was there, the judge. He said, I don't care what anybody says. I don't ever want to hear anybody say anything about Stark Paper Company. But if we have a chance to buy that lake, we should do it. So Fred Welling set a price of $8,000 on the property. And at that meeting, they selected a committee of three, Herb Leonard and John McCullough and me, to go see if we could borrow $8,000 from the bank. At that time, Mr. McCullough owned the bank. It was a family affair. So we made an appointment with Mr. Jones to go see him, and when we got there, John said, Larry, you do the talking. It was nice. They had all the money. I was going to do the talking. So we went in, Mr. Jones said, good morning, gentlemen. What can I do for you? I said, well, we're here on a funny mission. We have an opportunity to buy Lake Perrin from the Stark Paper Company for $8,000. We wonder if you might lend us the money. He looked right at John. He said, I think with proper signatures on the note, we could arrange that. Now I found out what John was there for. John said, I talked with Father. Father thinks he should give $1,000 to this project. And he suggested I give $1,000 and my sister give $1,000. Herb Leonard said, I think it's a good idea. I'll give $500. And Mr. Jones said, I'm not unaware of this. I'll give $500 too.
That's a loan officer.
We had $4,000 before we got started. We put a dummy up where the dummy was. We put a thermometer up there. We raised $12,000 in 2 weeks. Bought Lake Perrin and hired Elwood Allen Associates in Bennington to do all the planning for the waterfront and everything else. Yeah.
What year was that, do you think?
Well, Timmy was probably, God, I don't know, probably 47, 48, not very long after we got back here. Oh. Kids were all small. And it was interesting. They weren't double dipping. The mothers took care of kids. They didn't work. First 5 years we were open. Every morning, the mothers and their kids would arrive at Lake Perrin, and they took swimming lessons. Mm-hmm. And the bank would be covered with them for all the morning.
Yeah.
Babe was there every day, Mrs. Crane, all of them. And that was a really good time for 3 or 4 years.
Oh, it was a great gift to the village, too.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I still have back to Jim Holden saying, don't ask any questions. If you get a chance to buy it, take it. Mm-hmm.
Larry, what concerns you about the future of the village? If anything.
I think it's stable. I think we have one problem. Our problem is getting people to do the jobs that should be done. When you know they hired a new guy to run the highway department.
I knew they were going to. Yeah.
Well, the trustees didn't know what they were doing. So they put a notice in job fair that job was going to be available. They had 57 applications. They selected three. They interviewed three people and they found one guy with the very best. Knew how to take care of the equipment and everything else. So they hired him. 2 weeks after they hired him, he told them he had to go to Iraq for 6 months. I said, why the hell wouldn't you ask? He said, you can't ask those questions. I said, well, I would think I'd have found out before I did this. The guys, they're paying him and he's gone to Iraq. It's just, this is the problem. You can't get very many.
I'm sitting in the dark. Hi.
Okay.
There's a light out here, right here.
Oh. Okay.
It's trying to find the people to do the jobs.
Yeah.
They mean well. We've got a loaded cannon in this village going crazy. That Jimmy Johnson. He's the guy promoting the skate park. He's dangerous.
I'll edit that out of the tape.
Hmm?
I'll edit that one out of the tape. But
yeah, well, he's dangerous.
Yeah. What do you think about the idea of separating from Bennington to be a separate municipality rather than a village within the town?
Crazy, worst idea in the world. Absolutely. You know, they don't make any more towns in the state. They aren't going to make another town for North Bennington. They're going to change all the law books. We're going to have a separate art garden here. These people, the people that do that, they don't research. You think you could get another town through that legislature up there? I went to the legislature when the North Bay expanded their village limits out here. I sat there with Fred Welling. There was a guy on the committee there, sat there all day long. Finally said, well, I went through North Bennington once on a train. I don't see any need to change.
Was that changing out by Harlan Road, or was that changing out?
Harlan Road.
Was that by Harlan Road? But it got through?
It got through because all the people that lived there agreed to it. Right. And they were going to raise their taxes. Now the line was right up here by the cemetery, the end of the cemetery, that was the village line. It went right out through the field out there.
How did they get set that way? Do you have any idea? That was before your time. Did you have any idea how the village limits got established?
No, but there was a line, a diagonal line drawn from up by Main Street, right out across Lake Perrin, right out that way.
Mm.
I think some guy just laid down a ruler and drew a line.
Mm.
And then we expanded the village that way by the railroad track, all the way around to the yellow house out there now. And so Harlan Road, we tried to give Harlan Road to the town. They wouldn't take it. They said, you've got everything else, you take care of that road. So Harlan Road is in North Bennington. The town line is on the other side.
There were some changes made at one point, weren't there, out on West Street?
We expanded out there, too.
And why was the expansion out there?
I don't know.
And the line comes in on different locations on West Street, where they're coming from the north and the south.
You see, one time McCullough's owned a section, 640 acres out there. And I never knew where the village line was. I always thought it was the road, Madison Roadway down there. But it wasn't. It was up near the doctor's, where Carl Jolivet's comes out is right where your, the line was right where you got your road for a mile around woods. And they did expand. I don't know when that was done. See, there were an awful lot of inner workings in this village. And it went on, it was done very well, but Fred was involved in a lot of things that nobody really knew about. Now, when Miss Anderson, when, how, you got another 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Esther McCullough had a companion named Stella Anderson, who was a concert pianist. Esther hated to listen to her practice. So they lived in the park house, which is down past the garage. Esther built a studio for Stell in back of the garage, really nice studio. Hall did not like Miss Anderson. Esther bought the farm across the road from Ed Knapp, up toward where Kyle Jolivet is, for Miss Anderson.
The whole farm?
She bought a whole chunk of it.
Okay.
When Esther died, Hall went to Miss Anderson. He said, "Miss Anderson, I understand my sister bought you some land." She said, "Yes." He said, "If you will tell me where you want your studio, I'll place your studio on your land." So they went up and walked, and she showed him where she wanted it. He brought in a crew, took that whole stone wall down, numbered every piece, jacked that studio up, moved down the road and moved it up there and put it up on top of that hill. So, when she got up there, she needed water. Ken Cooch was the superintendent of the water department, and he and Fred were great friends. And Carl was building his house on top of the hill. So they ran a water main, a line, off Hall Street up to Carl's house and up to Miss Anderson's. They didn't have enough water. So every time Carl flushed his toilet, Miss Anderson didn't have any water. She called me one day about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She said, "Could you come?" "Yes, ma'am." She said, "Larry, I've got a problem." "What's that?" She said, "Good old Ken put me in a water line off that Hall Street thing, and every time Mr. Jolivet flushes the toilet, I've got no water. Could you do something about it?" And I said, "Yes." I went to see Fred, and I said, "Fred, you've got a problem. You took care of it with Scotch tape and Band-Aid, but now it's a problem. You've got houses on West Street that don't have any proper water. One is Ed Knapp's and one is Miss Anderson's." "Oh, God," he said, "we always were going to add a water main there, but we haven't done it." I said, "Well, you better do it now." So they had to put a whole new water main in up through there, and then finally Miss Anderson got her water. But up until then, they just stuck a hose on and said, "That'll take care of it."
What was the Knapp farm like when it was operating?
He was a horticulturist. And he raised trees and bushes.
And did he live on the property?
Oh, yeah.
Which house is that?
The house that the Frost Boy got. Now, when I was this high, a long time ago.
This high father, looks like about 3 feet.
I probably was six. My father used to take a horse and wagon and go out at the store taking orders. And we would go down Bank Street all the way down to where Bill Daly lived. At that time, that was the main road to Hoosick Falls. And then you got down there, and there was a driveway went down like this and went up over the tracks. That was the main road. So my father would go down there taking orders, and then we would go down to Sodom, to the state line. We would go as far as the Flynns, who lived just beyond the overpass, taking orders with a horse and wagon. When we came back from there, we would go up the other road, up on the river road to the right, and then go up past Mr. Knapp's back to the store. We had three or four houses in there. One was where Thornton Kinney lived, the slave, and the Brillians, and Mrs. Maycomber. And then we would turn and go up there and stop at Mr. Knapp's and get his order for groceries. And he lived with his mother, and she would always give us a cup of tea and a piece of cake. And Mr. Knapp had a pump organ, and he would play us some music while we're having our cake.
But he had that whole rolling hillside in horticultural goods?
Yeah, he had a big shed out in back. He had a guy named John Brennan and Bill Kenny that worked for him. Two men.
Now, I want to go back just a little bit. You said there was a slave?
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yes.
I guessed.
The paper mill. The big building beyond the paper mill, which is with burnt the top off, was Colonel Walbridge's place. When Colonel Walbridge came back from the Civil War, he brought back a slave named Thornton Jackson. And he worked here all around. He had four sons, Frank Kenny, Bill Kenny, John Kenny, and another one. And Bill Kenny was my father's age. He was born in 92, I think. And Mr. Jackson met a young lady here, and they got married, and they had four kids. And nobody ever, we all knew that they were part Negro. Nobody ever said anything. And Francis Kinney, the loudmouth on the school board, is a great grandson of that man.
Amazing. Did you know Colonel Walbridge at all? He must have died when you were quite young.
Didn't know him.
How about the Hall Farm itself, the other big farm off Park Street? Did that provide milk and such to the village, or was that really a separate operation?
I don't know how much you got to remember that, you know, where John lived up on top of Main Street in the brick house? That was part of McCullough. And they had the big house. They had Miss Van Benthusen across the street. They had four or five houses. They probably had 100 people work on that farm. Pat McCarthy was there. He was a poultry man, just took care of chickens and things like that. Lloyd Pratt's father was one of the herdsmen. They had a crew of men that cut lumber year-round to heat the big house.
But not in the Mile Around Woods. They weren't cutting there, were they?
No, they up on East Mountain. A man named Claude Baker was one of the guys there. He lived right on Easy Lane.
So was it a dairy operation?
Yeah.
And were they hauling milk to the railroad station and shipping it?
I don't know whether they shipped or not.
No.
No,
was the Mile Around Woods open to the village back in the 20s and the 30s, or was that really private enclave?
I don't think anybody ever went there. I really don't. Although they did have horse shows out there. But I don't know much about that.
So that was really private property that people didn't go on and do anything
with. Very, very. Much, much more so than it was later. Yeah. They were royalty. They were different. Mm-hmm. We supplied those people. Miss Johnson lived in the big house by herself for years and years and years. And we were forced to supply those people all the groceries. And they did a lot of entertaining. Yeah.
Was there much resentment, do you think, about their position?
No, I don't think there ever was, not a thing. Uh-huh. You know, when the Mrs. McCullough was the prime mover for Bennington College with Vincent Rabbi Booth in Bennington, she said she would raise the money, and she did. For Bennington College. The Jennings gave the land, they got the money.
Well, Larry, I thank you very much for your...
Well, if you can dissolve this down into about 3 minutes, you'll be all right.
I don't think I can dissolve this down to 3 minutes, but you have a wealth of information that a lot of it that no one else really has.
Well, the thing is that, as I said in my book, once we're gone, these stories are all going to die, and people are not going to remember them. But There's a million stories here, my God.
Well, if you'll indulge me maybe just a little bit longer, can you talk a little bit about the news agency, Percy's, and the role that it played in the village?
When my father worked in Hathaway's store there, where the store is now, and Mr. Shepherd bought it. And when he passed away, his son couldn't run it. So my father and another guy bought the store where the driving window is at the bank. That was in 32. And that was called Powers and Robinson. And with that driving, with that store there, the Stone House went next to it, where Bepley lives now. So my father sold the house here to get some money to start his business there, and we went into that Stone House. So I lived for 5 or 6 years on Main Street in North Bennington. At that time, Marty Percy ran a newsstand underneath the office for White Hotel. A man named George Houghton had run a grocery store on the corner where Tim Smith is. So he'd gone out of business, so Marty was able to get that and to open his newsstand down there. So when Mr. Shepherd passed away and the store closed, my father one day walked into the Jones, to the bank. Mr. Jones was there, and he said, "Michael," he said, "why don't you buy Shepherd's store?" This was in 33, right in the middle of the Depression. And my father said, "What with?" "Oh," he said, "you don't have to worry about that." He said, "we have the what with right here if you want to buy it." So my father bought Shepherd's store for $3,500. And they then put in it had been a three-floor store with a Masonic temple on the top floor. So they put all the store down on the first floor and put an apartment in on the second floor. And my father and mother lived in that apartment.
That was a second Masonic temple besides the one on Bank Street?
No, this was before the one on Bank Street existed. My brother and I had the Masonic temple as a bedroom with a stage in it. So I've lived on Main Street in North Bank since I was 5 years old.
Nice.
And so we were there. Well, my father finally rented a house beyond where Ronnie Natto is and lived there. And then after I was born, my brother was born, they were looking for a place to get out of there, so looked all over, and they finally bought this house up here, the second one down, and we moved up here.
And Percy's was running a full news agency in the right down from the store your father bought.
Percy had a short order cook, fountain, two pool tables in the back, and a newsroom. And the pool tables were very busy at that time. So Louise was a cook, and they ran a short order thing and a soda fountain, and they sold magazines and newspapers and a pool hall. Now, Pete Panos was up across where we lived there, and he had two pool tables too. And there were two pool halls in North Bennington.
And did they serve beer and alcohol as well?
No.
They were dry.
That didn't come until 32. Okay.
What a function did Bank Hall play back in those days?
Bank Hall was a theater, movie theater.
And was that showing films every weekend, or was that an occasional event?
Oh, I think it was every weekend. It was silent films. Thelma Gall played the piano, and they had no toilet facilities. My mother would take my brother and I to the movies, and she'd have to take a bottle with us so we could pee in it so we could watch the movie.
And that was accessed by a stairway in the back,
There was an iron staircase next to the rectangular building. The wing that's on there now wasn't there. and there was a stairs went up and went in.
And so who actually ran the films? Was
John James.
He just rented out the hall and had a projector? And was there a piano up there, so you had music?
Yeah. And there were, like, they would, some club would have a minstrel show or a stage show. There was a stage there,
And so was that in some ways the social center of the village, or was it more the school?
Pretty much. Yeah. See, the school, no, that was before the school. Up until, in 1936, the village decided to build a gymnasium. Before that, it was just a square building. It had 12 grades and about six rooms.
So that was right before you got into high school then?
Yeah, in June of 35, they decided to build a gymnasium. So in 1936, I went to school in the firehouse. They had a class in the Congregational Church, one in the Baptist Church. There were four classes outside of the school. And they built that gymnasium and put in five new classrooms. In about the middle of April of 36, we moved in there into the new school. Up until then, it was a very small building.
And that was all done with taxpayers' money in the village? Mm-hmm. So in the middle of the Depression, people were willing to put that money in?
Yeah, and it was, it didn't cost an awful lot, but it, they got some federal help from it. And built the big, that was a big gymnasium at that time. Oh. Yeah.
How many people in your graduating class?
18. 13 boys and 13 girls and 5 boys.
Oh.
Yeah. And there was a, it was all in one building. There wasn't any outside building. But there were 3 floors. The basement had 2 classrooms, had a laboratory, and then the other floors. Most classes were double. First and second grade, one room. Third and fourth, one room. Fifth and sixth, one room. And then high school. There wasn't any breakdown of junior high. You went fifth and sixth, seventh and eighth.
And there was there a, there wasn't an outhouse for that, was there? Was there
no, they had, when I was there, they had bathrooms.
Okay.
Yeah. Before that there was, but I don't know. It was a, it was an operation, but they, now, we didn't have enough kids here, so a lot of kids came down on the train from Arlington to go to high school here. The train was arranged, so they came down in the morning and went back in the afternoon.
It just stopped at that, oh, was there a station? There was a station in Arlington. Did they stop in North Shasbury?
No, in Arlington. There was one in Arlington.
Was there much of a connection with Troy and Albany back in the 30s?
No, not much. There were some medical facilities in Albany and Troy. I know I went, when I had some problems as a kid, I went to a doctor in Troy. Yeah.
Did many people go to New York City on the train? You said you went when you graduated from high school.
Well, I think there was quite a few passengers. They went there, not daily, but there was always somebody waiting to get on the train. Yeah.
Did Bennington Banner cover North Bennington very well?
Mm-hmm. A lot of, I think a lot of the traffic went from here to Albany and Troy, back and forth, too. Fred Simmons, one of the Simmons boys, went to business college in Troy, and when the big fire was here in 1918, he was in business college in Troy, and the principal came in and said, I think you ought to go home, Mr. Simmons. The whole village of North Benton's on fire.
How would he have gotten there in those days? On the train?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Larry, what do you miss about village life before the World War II? Is there anything in particular that seems to be missing and gone?
Yeah. I think you gotta remember now I'm almost 90. I miss all the people. When I grew up, I knew everybody in North Bennington. Everybody. Hell, I don't know anybody in this village anymore. But it was the people that were so much fun.
Well, one change I would think is that so many of us who live here don't work here. I'm a prime example.
That's true, yeah.
I drive 30 miles to 25 miles to work every day.
It's interesting that everything was in the village.
You needed to leave to go to the hospital.
Yeah, in 1932, I had ruptured appendix, and the hospital had burnt. And Dr. Dean, who came and lived here in North Bennington, had a big house in Bennington at that time, turned that into a hospital.
Huh.
And I went to the Dean Emergency Hospital to have my appendix out.
Huh.
Yeah, 32.
There was a jail in North Bennington, or at least a holding tank in those days?
Yep, behind the end of the Congregational Church, where Bud Briggs lives. You go up School Street from Bank Street, and the end, right on the end, Congregational Church, there was two cells.
And was that, the village owned them, or was that somebody's backyard?
That was the village. Also, there was two cells in the old fire, in the old grist mill, too.
Huh.
And I never saw them, but they were there.
And who provided police protection? Was this the sheriff?
Yeah, the
Clyde Peck and his boys?
Was it, no? In the books, early books I've got, that Mr. Phillips wrote, the chairman of the Board of Selectmen was the sheriff. All the trustees, he was a sheriff, and all the trustees were sheriffs.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, I thank you very much for taking the time and sharing a small fraction of what you know.
Oh, God.
It's really
You talked about the sheriff. We had a sheriff, a deputy sheriff in North Bennington named Ralph Cooch. Had a motorcycle. What's the matter?
She thinks we should have some light.
Well, I don't know how you can sit here in the dark.
We aren't looking at anything. We're just talking.
Well, I didn't do
what time
I'm
is
surprised
it?
You can see each other.
Is it 9 o'clock?
Okay.
It's 8:25.
We had a sheriff named Ralph Cooch. He had a motorcycle, full uputform, leather puttees, the whole nine yards. One night, a car came through.
Do you have any kids still at home, Robert?
I don't. They're all.
He has three daughters.
I thought.
Youngest is 21, and she's in college, and the other two are out of college. And
uh-huh.
One of them's married. And,
well, I saw in the paper when she got married.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you'll be a grandfather.
Maybe.
He's packing up to go.
Huh?
He's packing up to go. We're all through.
Oh, well.
So,
that's okay. We're all right now.
And we had a car come through North Bennington, a big touring car, and the sheriff took off after him. And I told you, the road went all the way down to Daly before it turned.
Right.
He didn't come back. And somebody came down and said, there's a terrible accident down the road. He had got forced off the road into a stone wall, broke every bone in his body. And where the villager is, at that time there was a large concrete thing in front.
Yeah.
They brought him up and laid him on the sidewalk till he could get an ambulance. And my brother and I were about 6 or 7 years old, and we lived in the stone house, and we had to go over and look at the guy going, That was the North Bank police force.
But the fire department was active.
You knew the fire department had four guys killed. Did you know that?
Back in the 19th century, down out by the state line,
Yeah, they were always active.
Yeah.
Junior Percy asked, when they built a new firehouse, before they built it, Junior Percy went to Paul McCullough and he said, Hall, we need a new firehouse. Mr. McCullough said, do you? Well, he said, I think the taxpayers should build their own firehouse. But if you build a firehouse, I'll give you a fire truck. That's how they got the new fire truck. Yeah. He was wonderful.
Was he very well known in the village? I mean, you know him very well, but did, and Art Wicken and did Fred, but did other people?
Well, I think a lot of people knew him. I don't think they dared to talk to him. Oh. He was royalty. He came down to Pete Lyons' barbershop every day to get shaved for a nickel.
He walked down or got driven down?
No, he had a Buick convertible. And Stubby Green was a drunk. Always around. I never knew he worked. When Hall McCullough came in the barbershop, everybody kind of sat to attention and never said anything. He came in, sat down in the chair and got shaved. He had priority. There were two chairs. Stubby came in one morning and Hall was laid back there and lathered up. Stubby went over and laid down in the other chair, laid back like this. Pete Lyons was just getting ready to shave Hall McCullough. Stubby goes, ah! Pete had a brush full of lather, stuck it right in Stubby's mouth.
That's great.
Those are the stories you forget.
I don't think you've forgotten a great number of them.
There's a lot of them. A lot of them. Have fun.
Larry, one other question I did think of is, what role did White's Hotel play in the village? Was that an active place when you were young?
No. There were three hotels when I was a boy. One by the railroad track, which was the Perrin Creek House, White Hotel, and down where the park is across from the library now was Henry Allen's Hotel. They were all gone by the time I did. But when White's Hotel, as I know it, was the main office for the H.C. White Company wasn't H.C. White. The White Company, they were coal dealers. And that's where Fred Welling, when they went out of business, Fred Welling bought that business. But that was coal. But they had five apartments.
Oh, so it wasn't a place you could come in on the train and get a room?
Not when I was a boy, no. And when I came back from the service, Babe and I got married in 45. That fall, we had an apartment in the White Hotel. And we lived there for 7 or 8 months. And then we finally moved up here on Mechanic Street.
So it was the first floor then just the offices? It wasn't a public space, really?
No, the office was there for the coal company. There was a woman who taught piano that lived on the same floor. Dr. Armstrong had his first offices on the second floor. And Ted Corliss lived there, who was the time and motion study man for Cushman. And Dr. Armstrong had a part of an apartment and two rooms for his offices, and he moved in when he moved down by the library.
And why did it close down finally? And why was it ripped down?
Turn that thing off.